Chapter 1. Understanding Energy. Fuels and Electricity. Consider a benign science fiction scenario. Not travel to distant planets in search of life, but the Earth and its inhabitants as targets of remote monitoring by an exceedingly sapient civilization that sends its probes to nearby galaxies. Why do they do this? Just for the satisfaction of systematic understanding, and perhaps also to avoid dangerous surprises should the third planet orbiting around an unremarkable star in a spiral galaxy become a threat, or perhaps in case they should require a second home. Hence, this planet keeps periodic tabs on Earth. Let us imagine that a probe approaches our planet once every 100 years, and that it is programmed to make a second pass, a closer inspection, only when it detects a previously unobserved kind of energy conversion, the changing of energy from one form to another, or a new physical manifestation dependent on it. In fundamental physical terms, any process, be it rain, a volcanic eruption, plant growth, animal predation, or the growth of human sapience, can be defined as a sequence of energy conversions, and for a few 100 million years after the Earth's formation, the probes would see only the same varied but ultimately monotonous displays of volcanic eruptions, earthquakes, and atmospheric storms. Fundamental shifts. The first microorganisms emerged nearly 4 billion years ago, but passing probes do not register them, as these life forms are rare and remain hidden, associated with alkaline hydrothermal vents at the ocean's floor. The first occasion for a closer look arises as early as 3.5 billion years ago, when a passing probe records the first simple single-celled photosynthetic microbes in shallow seas. They absorb near-infrared radiation, that which is just beyond the visible spectrum, and do not produce oxygen. Hundreds of millions of years then elapse with no signs of change before cyanobacteria begin to use the energy of the visible incoming solar radiation to convert CO2 and water into new organic compounds and release oxygen. This is a radical shift that will create Earth's oxygenated atmosphere. Yet a long time elapses before new, more complex aquatic organisms are seen 1.2 billion years ago, when the probes document the rise and diffusion of brilliantly coloured red algae due to the photosynthetic pigment phycoerythrin, and of much larger brown algae. Green algae arrive nearly 500 million years later, and because of the new proliferation of marine plants, the probes get better sensors to monitor the sea floor. This pays off, as more than 600 million years ago, the probes make another epochal discovery: the existence of the first organisms made of differentiated cells. These flattish, soft, bottom-dwelling creatures, known as Ediacaran fauna after their Australian domicile, are the first simple animals requiring oxygen for their metabolism and, unlike algae that are merely tossed by waves and currents, they are mobile. And then the probes begin to document what are, comparatively speaking, rapid changes. Instead of passing over lifeless continents and waiting hundreds of millions of years before logging another epochal shift, they begin to record the rising, cresting, and subsiding waves of the emergence, diffusion, and extinction of a huge variety of species. This period starts with the Cambrian explosion of small marine bottom dwellers, 541 million years ago, dominated first by trilobites, through the arrival of the first fishes, amphibians, land plants, and four-legged, and hence exceptionally mobile, animals. Periodic extinctions reduce or sometimes almost eliminate this variety, and even just 6 million years ago, the probes do not find any organism dominating the planet. Not long afterwards, the probes nearly miss the significance of a mechanical shift with enormous energetic implications. Many four-legged animals briefly stand or awkwardly walk on two legs, and more than 4 million years ago, this form of locomotion becomes the norm for small ape-like creatures that begin spending more time on land than in trees. Now the intervals between reporting something noteworthy to their home base shrink from hundreds of millions to mere hundreds of thousands of years. Eventually, the descendants of these early bipeds, we classify them as hominins, belonging to the genus Homo, along the long line of our ancestors, do something that puts them on an accelerated path to planetary dominance. Several hundred thousand years ago, the probes detect the first extrasomatic use of energy, external to one's body, that is, any energy conversion besides digesting food, when some of these upright walkers master fire and begin to use it deliberately for cooking, comfort, and safety. This controlled combustion converts the chemical energy of plants into thermal energy and light, enabling the hominins to eat previously hard-to-digest foods, warming them through the cold nights and keeping away dangerous animals. These are the first steps towards deliberately shaping and controlling the environment on an unprecedented scale. This trend intensifies with the next notable change, the adoption of crop cultivation. About 10 millennia ago, the probes record the first patches of deliberately cultivated plants as a small share of the Earth's total photosynthesis becomes controlled and manipulated by humans, who domesticate, select, plant, tend and harvest crops for their delayed benefit. The first domestication of animals soon follows. Before that happens, human muscles are the only prime movers, that is, converters of chemical, food, energy, to the kinetic, mechanical energy of labour. Domestication of working animals, starting with cattle some 9,000 years ago, supplies the first extrasomatic energy other than that of human muscles. They are used for field work, for lifting water from wells, for pulling or carrying loads, and for providing personal transportation. And much later come the first inanimate prime movers. Sails, more than 5 millennia ago, water wheels, more than 2 millennia ago, and windmills, more than 1,000 years ago. Afterwards, the probes don't have much to observe, following the arrival of another period of relative slowdown. Century after century, there is just repetition, stagnation, or the slow growth and diffusion of these long-established conversions. In the Americas and in Australia, lacking any draft animals and any simple mechanical prime movers, all work before the arrival of Europeans is done by human muscles. In some of the old world's pre-industrial regions, harnessed animals, wind and running or falling water energize significant shares of grain milling, oil pressing, grinding and forging, and draft animals become indispensable for heavy field work, ploughing above all, as harvesting is still done manually, transporting goods and waging wars. But at this point, even in societies with domesticated animals and mechanical prime movers, much of the work is still done by people. My estimate, using necessarily approximate past totals of working animals and people and assuming typical daily work rates based on modern measurements of physical exertion, is that, be it at the beginning of the second millennium of the Common Era or 500 years later, in 1500, at the beginning of the early modern era, more than 90% of all useful mechanical energy was provided by animate power, roughly split between people and animals, while all thermal energy came from the combustion of plant fuels, mostly wood and charcoal, but also straw and dried dung. And then in 1600, the alien probe will spring into action and spot something unprecedented. Rather than relying solely on wood, an island society is increasingly burning coal, a fuel produced by photosynthesis tens or hundreds of millions of years ago and fossilized by heat and pressure during its long underground storage. The best reconstructions show that coal as a heat source in England surpasses the use of biomass fuels around 1620, perhaps even earlier. By 1650, the burning of fossil carbon supplies two-thirds of all heat, and the share reaches 75% by 1700. England has an exceptionally early start. All the coal fields that make the UK the world's leading 19th century economy are already producing coal before 1640. And then, at the very beginning of the 18th century, some English mines begin to rely on steam engines, the first inanimate prime movers powered by the combustion of fossil fuel. These early engines are so inefficient that they can be deployed only in mines, where the fuel supply is readily available and does not require any transportation. But for generations, the UK remains the most interesting nation to the alien probe because it is an exceptional early adopter. Even by 1800, the combined coal extraction in a few European countries and the United States is a small fraction of British production. By 1800, a passing probe will record that across the planet, plant fuels still supply more than 98% of all heat and light used by the dominant bipeds, and that human and animal muscles still provide more than 90% of all mechanical energy needed in farming, construction, and manufacturing. In the UK, where James Watt introduced an improved steam engine during the 1770s, the Boulton and Watt Company begin to build engines whose average power is equal to that of 25 strong horses. But by 1800, they have sold less than 500 of these machines, merely denting the total power provided by harnessed horses and hard-working labourers. Even by 1850, rising coal extraction in Europe and North America supplies no more than 7% of all fuel energy. Nearly half of all useful kinetic energy comes from draft animals, about 40% from human muscles, and just 15% from the three inanimate prime movers: water wheels, windmills, and the slowly spreading steam engines. The world of 1850 is much more akin to the world of 1700, or even of 1600, than that of the year 2000. But by 1900, the global share of both fossil and renewable fuels and of prime movers shifts considerably as modern energy sources, coal and some crude oil, provide half of all primary energy, and traditional fuels, wood, charcoal, straw, the other half. Water turbines in hydro stations generate the first primary electricity during the 1880s. Later comes geothermal electricity, and after the Second World War, nuclear, solar, and wind electricity, the new renewables. But by 2020, more than half of the world's electricity will still be generated by the combustion of fossil fuels, mainly coal and natural gas. By 1900, inanimate prime movers supply about half of all mechanical energy. Coal-fired steam engines make the greatest contribution, followed by better designed water wheels and new water turbines, first introduced during the 1830s, windmills and brand new steam turbines since the late 1880s, and internal combustion engines, gasoline-fueled, also first introduced in the 1880s. By 1950, fossil fuels supply nearly three-quarters of primary energy, still dominated by coal, and inanimate prime movers, now with gasoline and diesel-fueled internal combustion engines in the lead, provide more than 80% of all mechanical energy. And by the year 2000, only poor people in low-income countries depend on biomass fuels, with wood and straw providing only about 12% of the world's primary energy. Animate prime movers hold only a 5% share of mechanical energy, as human exertions and the work of draft animals are almost completely displaced by machines fueled by liquids or by electric motors. During the past two centuries, the alien probes will have witnessed a rapid global substitution of primary energy sources, accompanied by the expansion and diversification of fossil energy supply and the no less rapid introduction, adoption, and growth in capacity of new inanimate prime movers. First coal-fired steam engines, then internal combustion engines, piston and turbines. The most recent visit would see a truly global society built and defined by mass-scale, stationary and mobile conversions of fossil carbon, deployed everywhere but in some of the planet's uninhabited regions. Modern energy uses. What difference has this mobilization of extrasomatic energies made? Global primary energy supply usually refers to total or gross production, but it is more revealing to look at energy that is actually available for conversion into useful forms. To do this, we need to subtract pre-consumption losses, During coal sorting and cleaning, crude oil refining and natural gas processing, non-energy use, mainly as feedstocks for chemical industries, and also as lubricating oils for machines ranging from pumps to aircraft turbines and as paving materials, and losses during electricity transmission. With these adjustments, and rounding heavily to avoid impressions of unwarranted accuracy, my calculations show a 60-fold increase in the use of fossil fuels during the 19th century, a 16-fold gain during the 20th century, and about a 1,500-fold increase over the past 220 years. This increasing dependence on fossil fuels is the most important factor in explaining the advances of modern civilization, and also our underlying concerns about the vulnerability of their supply and the environmental impacts of their combustion. In reality, the energy gain was substantially higher than the 1,500-fold I just mentioned, because we must take into account the concurrent increase in average conversion efficiencies. In 1800, coal combustion in stoves and boilers to produce heat and hot water was no more than 25 to 30% efficient, and only 2% of coal consumed by steam engines was converted into useful work, resulting in an overall conversion efficiency of no higher than 15%. A century later, better stoves, boilers, and engines raised the overall efficiency to nearly 20%, and by the year 2000, the mean conversion rate was about 50%. Consequently, the 20th century saw a nearly 40-fold gain in useful energy. Since 1800, the gain was about 3,500-fold. To get an even clearer picture of the magnitude of these changes, we should express these rates in per capita terms. The global population rose from 1 billion in 1800 to 1.6 billion in 1900 and 6.1 billion in the year 2000. And hence the supply of useful energy rose, all values in gigajoules per capita, from 0.05 in 1800 to 2.7 in 1900 and to about 28 in the year 2000. China's post-2000 rise on the world stage was the main reason for a further increase in the global rate to about 34 gigajoules per capita by 2020. An average inhabitant of the Earth nowadays has at their disposal nearly 700 times more useful energy than their ancestors had at the beginning of the 19th century. Moreover, within a lifetime of people born just after the Second World War, the rate had more than tripled, from about 10 to 34 gigajoules per capita between 1950 and 2020. Translating the last rate into more readily imaginable equivalents, it is as if an average Earthling has every year at their personal disposal about 800 kilograms, 0.8 tons or nearly 6 barrels of crude oil, or about 1.5 tons of good bituminous coal. And, when put in terms of physical labour, it is as if 60 adults would be working non-stop day and night for each average person. And for the inhabitants of affluent countries, this equivalent of steadily labouring adults would be, depending on the specific country, mostly between 200 and 240. On average, humans now have unprecedented amounts of energy at their disposal. The consequences of this in terms of human exertion, hours of physical labour, time for leisure, and the overall standard of living are obvious. An abundance of useful energy underlies and explains all the gains. From better eating to mass-scale travel. From mechanisation of production and transport to instant personal electronic communication that have become norms rather than exceptions in all affluent countries. Recent changes on a national scale range widely. As expected, they are lower for those high-income countries whose per capita energy use was already relatively high a century ago, with a greater increase in nations that have seen the most rapid modernization of their economies since 1950, most notably Japan, South Korea, and China. Between 1950 and 2020, the United States roughly doubled the per capita useful energy provided by fossil fuels and primary electricity to about 150 gigajoules. In Japan, the rate had more than quintupled to nearly 80 gigajoules per capita. and China saw an astounding more than 120-fold increase to nearly 50 gigajoules per capita. Tracing the trajectory of useful energy deployment is so revealing because energy is not just another component in the complex structures of the biosphere, human societies, and their economies, nor just another variable in intricate equations determining the evolution of these interacting systems. Energy conversions are the very basis of life and evolution. Modern history can be seen as an unusually rapid sequence of transitions to new energy sources, and the modern world is the cumulative result of their conversions. Physicists were the first to recognize the fundamental importance of energy in human affairs. In 1886, Ludwig Boltzmann, one of the founders of thermodynamics, spoke about free energy, energy available for conversions, as the Kampfobjekt, the object of struggle for life, which is ultimately dependent on incoming solar radiation. Erwin Schrödinger, winner of the Nobel Prize in Physics in 1933, summed up the basis of life. What an organism feeds upon is negative entropy. Negative entropy, or negentropy, equals free energy. During the 1920s, following this fundamental insight of 19th and early 20th century physicists, the American mathematician and statistician Alfred Lotka concluded that those organisms that best capture the available energy hold the evolutionary advantage. In the early 1970s, American ecologist Howard Odum explained how all progress is due to special power subsidies and progress evaporates whenever and wherever they are removed. And more recently, physicist Robert Ayres has repeatedly stressed in his writings the central notion of energy in all economies. The economic system is essentially a system for extracting, processing, and transforming energy as resources into energy embodied in products and services. Simply put, energy is the only truly universal currency, and nothing, from galactic rotations to ephemeral insect lives, can take place without its transformations. Given all these readily verifiable realities, it is hard to understand why modern economics, that body of explanations and precepts whose practitioners exercise more influence on public policy than any other experts, has largely ignored energy. As Ayres noted, economics does not only lack any systematic awareness of energy's importance for the physical process of production, but it assumes that energy doesn't matter much because the cost share of energy in the economy is so small that it can be ignored, as if output could be produced by labour and capital alone, or as if energy is merely a form of man-made capital that can be produced, as opposed to extracted, by labour and capital. Modern economists do not get their rewards and awards for being preoccupied with energy, and modern societies become concerned about it only when the supply of any main commercial form of energy appears to be threatened and its prices soar. Google's Engram Viewer, a tool that allows you to see the popularity of terms that appeared in printed sources between 1500 and 2019, illustrates this point. During the 20th century, the frequency of the term energy price remained quite negligible, until a sudden spike that began in the early 1970s, caused by OPEC's quintupling of crude oil prices, details of which follow later in this chapter, and peaked in the early 1980s. Once prices fell, a similarly steep decline followed, and by 2019, the term energy price was mentioned no more frequently than it was in 1972. Understanding how the world really works cannot be done without at least a modicum of energy literacy. In this chapter, I will first explain that energy may not be easy to define, but that it is easy not to make the commonly encountered error of conflating it with power. We'll see how different forms of energy, with their specific advantages and drawbacks, and different energy densities, energy stored per unit of mass or volume, critical for energy storage and portability, have affected different stages of economic development, and I'll offer some realistic appraisals of the challenges faced by the unfolding transition to societies relying less and less on fossil carbon. As we'll see, Our civilization is so deeply reliant on fossil fuels that the next transition will take much longer than most people think. What is energy? How do we define this fundamental quantity? The Greek etymology is clear. Aristotle, writing in his Metaphysics, combined en, or in, with ergon, work, and concluded that every object is maintained by energeia. This understanding endowed all objects with the potential for action, motion, and change. Not a bad characterization of a potential to be transformed into other forms, be it by lifting, throwing, or burning. Little changed over the following two millennia. Eventually, Isaac Newton, 1643 to 1727, laid down fundamental physical laws involving mass, force, and momentum, and his second law of motion made it possible to derive the basic energy units. Using modern scientific units, one joule is the force of one newton, that is, the mass of 1 kilogram, accelerated by 1 meter per second squared, acting over a distance of 1 meter. But this definition refers only to kinetic or mechanical energy, and it certainly does not provide an intuitive understanding of energy in all its forms. Our practical understanding of energy was greatly expanded during the 19th century, thanks to the era's proliferating experiments with combustion, heat, radiation, and motion. This led to what is still the most common definition of energy, the capacity for doing work, a definition valid only when the term work means not only some invested labour, but, as one of the leading physicists of the era put it, a generalised physical act of producing a change of configuration in a system in opposition to a force which resists that change. But that, too, is still too Newtonian to be intuitive. There is no better way to answer the question, what is energy, than by referring to one of the most insightful physicists of the 20th century, to the protean mind of Richard Feynman, who, in his famous lectures on physics, tackled the challenge in his straightforward manner, stressing that energy has a large number of different forms and there is a formula for each one. These are gravitational energy, kinetic energy, heat energy, elastic energy, electrical energy, chemical energy, radiant energy, nuclear energy, mass energy. And then comes this disarming but indubitable conclusion. It is important to realise that in physics today, we have no knowledge of what energy is. We do not have a picture that energy comes in little blobs of a definite amount. It is not that way. However, there are formulas for calculating some numerical quantity, and when we add it all together, it gives always the same number. It is an abstract thing in that it does not tell us the mechanism or the reasons for the various formulas. And so it has been. We can use formulas to calculate, very accurately, the kinetic energy of a moving arrow or of a cruising jetliner, or the potential energy of a massive boulder that is just about to tumble down from a mountain, or the thermal energy released by a chemical reaction, or the light or radiant energy of a flickering candle or a pointed laser. But we cannot reduce these energies into a single, easily described entity in our mind. But the slippery nature of energy has not troubled the armies of instant experts. Ever since the early 1970s, when energy became a major topic of public discourse, they have opined on energy matters with ignorance and zeal. Energy is among the most elusive and misunderstood concepts, and a poor grasp of basic realities has led to many illusions and delusions. As we have seen, energy exists in various forms, and to make it useful to us, we need to convert one form of it into another type. But treating this multifaceted abstract as a monolith has been the norm, as if different forms of energy were effortlessly substitutable. Some of these substitutions are both relatively easy and beneficial. Replacing candles, the chemical energy of wax transformed into radiant energy, with electric lights powered by electricity generated by steam turbines, the chemical energy of fuels transformed first into heat and then into electric energy, which is then transformed into radiant energy, resulted in many obvious benefits. A safer, brighter, cheaper, and more reliable kind of energy. Replacing steam and diesel-powered railroad engines with electric drive has allowed less expensive, cleaner, and faster transportation. All sleek, high-speed trains are electric. But many desirable substitutions remain more expensive, or possible but realistically unaffordable for some time to come, or impossible at required scales, no matter how loudly their promoters extol their virtues. Electric cars are a common example of the first category. Now readily available, the best models are quite reliable. But in 2020, they were still more expensive than similarly sized vehicles powered by internal combustion engines. In terms of the second category, as I will detail in the next chapter, synthesis of the ammonia needed to produce nitrogenous fertilizers now depends heavily on natural gas as the source of hydrogen. Hydrogen could be produced by the decomposition, or electrolysis, of water instead, but this route remains nearly five times as expensive as when the element is derived from abundant and inexpensive methane. And we have yet to create a mass-scale hydrogen industry. And long-distance electricity-powered commercial flight, equivalent to a kerosene-powered Boeing 787 from New York to Tokyo, is the outstanding example of the last category. As we will see, this is an energy conversion that will remain unrealistic for a long time to come. The first law of thermodynamics states that no energy is ever lost during conversions, be that chemical to chemical when digesting food, chemical to mechanical when moving muscles, chemical to thermal when burning natural gas, thermal to mechanical when rotating a turbine, mechanical to electrical in a generator, or electrical to electromagnetic as a light illuminates a page you might read. However, all energy conversions eventually result in dissipated low-temperature heat. No energy has been lost, but its utility, its ability to perform useful work, is gone. The second law of thermodynamics. All forms of energy can be measured in the same units. Joule is the scientific unit. Calories are often used in nutritional studies. In the next chapter, when I detail the massive energy subsidies going into modern food production, we will encounter the truly existential reality of different energy qualities. Producing chicken requires energies whose total is several times higher than the energy content of the edible meat. Although we can calculate the subsidy ratio in terms of energy quantities, joules in, joules out, there is obviously a fundamental difference between inputs and outputs. We cannot digest diesel, oil, or electricity, while lean chicken meat is an almost perfectly digestible foodstuff containing high-quality protein, an indispensable macronutrient that cannot be replaced by an equal amount of energy from lipids or carbohydrates. There are many choices available when it comes to energy conversions, some far better than others. The high densities of chemical energy in kerosene and diesel fuel are great for intercontinental flying and shipping. But if you want your submarine to stay submerged while crossing the Pacific Ocean, then the best choice is to fission enriched uranium in a small reactor in order to produce electricity. And back on land, large nuclear reactors are the most reliable producers of electricity. Some of them now generate it 90 to 95% of the time, compared to about 45% for the best offshore wind turbines and 25% for photovoltaic cells in even the sunniest of climates. While Germany's solar panels produce electricity only about 12% of the time. This is simple physics or electrical engineering, but it is remarkable how often these realities are ignored. Another common mistake is to confuse energy with power, and this is done even more frequently. It betrays an ignorance of basic physics, and one that, regrettably, is not limited to lay usage. Energy is a scalar, which in physics is a quantity described only by its magnitude. Volume, mass, density, time, and speed are other ubiquitous scalars. Power measures energy per unit of time, and hence it is a rate. In physics, a rate measures change, commonly per time. Establishments that generate electricity are commonly called power plants, but power is simply the rate of energy production or energy use. Power equals energy divided by time. In scientific units, it is watts equals joules divided by seconds. Energy equals power multiplied by time. Joules equals watts multiplied by seconds. If you light a small votive candle in a Roman church, it might burn for 15 hours, converting the chemical energy of wax to heat, thermal energy, and light, electromagnetic energy, with an average power of nearly 40 watts. Unfortunately, even engineering publications often write about a power station generating 1,000 megawatts of electricity. But that is impossible. A generating station may have installed or rated power of 1,000 megawatts, that is, it can produce electricity at that rate, but when doing so, it would generate 1,000 megawatt hours, or in basic scientific units, 3.6 trillion joules in an hour. 1,000 million watts multiplied by 3,600 seconds. Analogically, an adult man's basal metabolic rate, the energy required at complete rest to run the body's essential functions, is about 80 watts, or 80 joules per second. Lying prone all day, a 70-kilogram man would still need about 7 megajoules, 80 multiplied by 24 multiplied by 3,600, of food energy, or about 1,650 kilocalories, to maintain his body temperature, energize his beating heart, and run myriad enzymatic reactions. Most recently, a poor understanding of energy has the proponents of a new green world naively calling for a near-instant shift from abominable polluting and finite fossil fuels to superior green and ever-renewable solar electricity. But liquid hydrocarbons refined from crude oil, gasoline, aviation kerosene, diesel fuel, residual heavy oil, have the highest energy densities of all commonly available fuels. And hence they are eminently suitable for energizing all modes of transportation. Here is a density ladder, all rates in gigajoules per ton. Air-dried wood, 16. Bituminous coal, depending on quality, 24 to 30. Kerosene and diesel fuels, about 46. In volume terms, all rates in gigajoules per cubic meter, energy densities are only about 10 for wood, 26 for good coal, 38 for kerosene. Natural gas, or methane, contains only 35 megajoules per meters cubed, or less than 1,000th of kerosene's density. The implications of energy density, as well as of fuel's physical properties, for transport are obvious. Ocean liners powered by steam engines did not burn wood because, everything else being equal, firewood would have taken up 2.5 times the volume of the good bituminous coal required for a transatlantic crossing, and be at least 50% heavier, greatly reducing the ship's capacity to transport people and goods. There could be no natural gas-powered flight, as the energy density of methane is 3 orders of magnitude lower than that of aviation kerosene, and also no coal-powered flight. The density difference is not that large, but coal would not flow from wing tanks to engines. And the advantages of liquid fuels go far beyond high energy density. Unlike coal, crude oil is much easier to produce. No need to send miners underground or scar landscapes with large open pits. Store, in tanks or underground because of oil's much higher energy density, any enclosed space can typically store 75% more energy as a liquid fuel than as coal. And distribute, intercontinentally by tankers and by pipelines, the safest mode of long-distance mass transfer, and hence it is readily available on demand. Crude oil needs refining to separate the complex mixture of hydrocarbons into specific fuel, gasoline being the lightest, residual fuel oil the heaviest, but this process yields more valuable fuels for specific uses, and it also produces indispensable non-fuel products such as lubricants. Lubricants are needed to minimize friction in everything from the massive turbofan engines in wide-body jetliners to miniature bearings. Globally, the automotive sector, now with more than 1.4 billion vehicles on the road, is the largest consumer, followed by use in industry, with the largest markets being textiles, energy, chemicals, and food processing, and in ocean-going vessels. annual use of these compounds now surpasses 120 megatons. For comparison, global output of all edible oils from olive to soybean is now about 200 megatons a year. And because the available alternatives, synthetic lubricants made from simpler but still often oil-based compounds rather than those derived directly from crude oil, are more expensive, this demand will grow further as these industries expand around the world. Another product derived from crude oil is asphalt. Global output of this black and sticky material is now on the order of 100 megatons, with 85% of it going to paving, hot and warm asphalt mixes, and most of the rest to roofing. And hydrocarbons have yet another indispensable non-fuel use, as feedstocks for many different chemical syntheses, dominated by ethane, propane, and butane from natural gas liquids, producing a variety of synthetic fibres, resins, adhesives, dyes, paints and coatings, detergents and pesticides, all vital in myriad ways to our modern world. Given these advantages and benefits, it was predictable, indeed unavoidable, that our dependence on crude oil would grow once the product became more affordable and once it could be reliably delivered on a global scale. The shift from coal to crude oil took generations to accomplish. Commercial crude oil extraction began during the 1850s in Russia, Canada, and the US. The wells, drilled using the ancient percussion method involving the raising and dropping of a heavy cutting bit, were shallow. Their daily productivities were low, and kerosene for lamps, which displaced whale oil and candles, was the main product of the simple refining of crude oil. New markets for refined oil products were created only with the widespread adoption of internal combustion engines. First, the gasoline-fueled, or Otto-cycle machines for cars, buses and trucks, then Rudolf Diesel's more efficient machines, fueled by a heavier and cheaper fraction, you guessed it, diesel, and used above all for ships, trucks and heavy machinery. For much more on this, see Chapter 4 on globalisation. Diffusion of these new prime movers was slow, and the US and Canada were the only two countries with high rates of car ownership prior to the Second World War. Crude oil became a global fuel and eventually the world's most important source of primary energy, thanks to the discoveries of giant oil fields in the Middle East and in the USSR, and of course also thanks to the introduction of large tankers. Some Middle Eastern giants were first drilled in the 1920s and 1930s. Iranian Gaxaran and Iraqi Kirkuk in 1927, Kuwaiti Bergen in 1937, but most of them were discovered after the war, including Gawa, the world's largest, in 1948, Safaniya in 1951 and Manifa in 1957, all in Saudi Arabia. The largest Soviet discoveries were in 1948. Romashkino in the Volga-Ural Basin, and in 1965, Samotla in western Siberia. Crude oil's rise and relative retreat. Mass-scale car usage in Europe and Japan, and the concurrent conversion of their economies from coal to crude oil, and later to natural gas, began only during the 1950s, as did the expansion of foreign trade and travel, including the first jetliners and the use of petrochemical feedstocks for the synthesis of ammonia and plastics. Global oil extraction of crude oil doubled during the 1950s, and by 1964, crude oil surpassed coal as the world's most important fossil fuel. But although its output kept on rising, supply remained plentiful, and so prices were falling. In constant inflation-adjusted monies, the world oil price was lower in 1950 than it was in 1940, lower in 1960 than in 1950, and lower still in 1970 than in 1960. Not surprisingly, demand was coming from all sectors. In real terms, crude oil was so cheap that there were no incentives to use it efficiently. American houses in regions with a cold climate, increasingly heated by oil furnaces, were built with single glazed windows and without adequate wall insulation. The average efficiency of American cars actually declined between 1933 and 1973, and energy-intensive industries continued to operate by using inefficient processes. Perhaps most notably, America's pace of replacing old open hearth furnaces with superior oxygen furnaces to make steel was much slower than in Japan and Western Europe. During the late 1960s, the already high American demand for oil rose by nearly 25%, and global demand increased by nearly 50%. European demand had nearly doubled between 1965 and 1973, and Japanese imports became about 2.3 times higher. As mentioned, new discoveries of oil covered this surge in demand, and oil was selling at what was essentially the same price as in 1950. This was too good to last, however. In 1950, the US still produced about 53% of the world's oil. By 1970, although still the largest producer, its share fell to less than 23%, and it was clear that the country would need increased imports, while the Organization of the Petroleum Exporting Countries, or OPEC, produced 48%. OPEC, set up in 1960 in Baghdad by just five countries in order to prevent further price reductions, had time on its side. It wasn't large enough to assert itself during the 1960s, but by 1970, its production share, combined with the retreat of American extraction, which peaked in 1970, made it impossible to ignore its demands. In April 1972, the Texas Railroad Commission lifted its limits on the state's output and hence surrendered its control of the price that it had held since the 1930s. In 1971, Algeria and Libya began to nationalize their oil production, and Iraq followed in 1972, the same year that Kuwait, Qatar, and Saudi Arabia began their gradual takeover of their oil fields, which, until that point, had been in the hands of foreign corporations. Then, in April 1973, the US ended its limits on the import of crude oil east of the Rocky Mountains. Suddenly, it was a seller's market, and on October 1, 1973, OPEC raised its posted price by 16% to $3.01 per barrel, followed by an additional 17% rise by six Arab Gulf states, and after the Israeli victory over Egypt in Sinai in October 1973, it embargoed all oil exports to the US. On the 1st of January 1974, the Gulf states raised their posted price to $11.65 a barrel, completing a 4.5-fold rise in the cost of this essential energy source in a single year. And this ended the era of rapid economic expansion that had been energized by cheap oil. From 1950 to 1973, the Western European economic product had nearly tripled, and the US GDP had more than doubled in that single generation. Between 1973 and 1975, the global economic growth rate dropped by about 90%, and as soon as the economies affected by higher oil prices began to adjust to these new realities, above all by impressive improvements in industrial energy efficiency, the fall of the Iranian monarchy and the takeover of Iran by a fundamentalist theocracy led to a second wave of oil price rises from about $13 in 1978 to $34 in 1981, and to another 90% decline in the global rate of economic growth between 1979 and 1982. More than $30 a barrel was a demand-destroying price, and by 1986, oil was again selling at just $13 a barrel, setting the stage for yet another round of globalization, this time centered on China, whose rapid modernization was driven by Deng Xiaoping's economic reforms and by massive foreign investment. Two generations later, only those who lived through those years of price and supply turmoil, or those increasingly few who study their impact, appreciate how traumatic these two waves of price rises were. Consequences of the resulting economic reversals are still felt four decades later, because once demand for oil began to increase, many oil-saving measures remained in place, and some, notably the transitions to more efficient industrial uses, kept on intensifying. In 1995, crude oil extraction finally surpassed the 1979 record and then continued to rise, meeting the demand of an economically reforming China as well as the rising demand elsewhere in Asia. Oil has not regained its pre-1975 relative dominance. Its share of the global commercial primary energy supply fell from 45% in 1970 to 38% in the year 2000 and to 33% in 2019. And it is now certain that its further relative decline will continue as natural gas consumption and wind and solar electricity generation keep increasing. There are enormous opportunities to generate more electricity with photovoltaic cells and wind turbines, but there is a fundamental difference between systems that derive 20 to 40% of electricity from these intermittent sources. Germany and Spain are the best examples among large economies, and a national electricity supply that relies completely on these renewable flows. In large, populous nations, the complete reliance on these renewables would require what we are still missing: either mass-scale, long-term, days-to-weeks electricity storage that would back up intermittent electricity generation, or extensive grids of high-voltage lines to transmit electricity across time zones and from sunny and windy regions to major urban and industrial concentrations. Could these new renewables produce enough electricity to replace not only today's generation fueled by coal and natural gas, but also all the energy now supplied by liquid fuels to vehicles, ships and planes by way of a complete electrification of transport? And could they really do so, as some plans now promise, in a matter of just 2 or 3 decades? The many advantages of electricity. If energy, according to Feynman, is that abstract thing, then electricity is one of its most abstract forms. You don't need a scientific understanding to have direct experience of several different types of energy to distinguish their forms and take advantage of their conversions. Solid or liquid fuels, chemical energy, are tangible: a tree trunk, a lump of coal, a canister of gasoline, and their burning, be it in forest fires, in Paleolithic caves, in locomotives to produce steam, or in motor vehicles, releases heat or thermal energy. Falling and running waters are ubiquitous displays of gravitational and kinetic energy that are fairly easily converted to useful kinetic or mechanical energy by building simple wooden water wheels. And all it takes to convert wind's kinetic energy into mechanical energy for grinding grain or pressing oil seeds is a windmill and wooden gears to transfer the motion to millstones. In contrast, electricity is intangible, and we can't get an intuitive sense of it in the same way as we do with fuels. But its effects can be seen in static electricity: sparks, lightning, small currents can be felt, and currents above 100 milliamperes may be deadly. Common definitions of electricity are not instinctively accessible. They require a prior knowledge of other functional terms such as electrons, flow, charge, and current. Although Feynman, in the opening volume of his magisterial Lectures on Physics, was quite perfunctory, there is electrical energy which has to do with pushing and pulling by electric charges. When he returned to the topic in detail in the second volume, dealing with mechanical and electrical energies and with steady currents, he did so by deploying calculus. For most of its inhabitants, the modern world is full of black boxes, devices whose internal workings remain, to different degrees, a mystery to their users. Electricity can be thought of as a ubiquitous and ultimate black box system. Although many people have a fairly good understanding of what goes in — combustion of fossil fuel in a large thermal plant, falling water in a hydro station, solar radiation absorbed by a photovoltaic cell, the splitting of uranium in a reactor — and everybody benefits from what comes out — light, heat, motion — only a minority fully understand what goes on inside the generating plants, transformers, transmission lines, and final use devices. Lightning, electricity's most common natural demonstration, is too powerful, too short-lived, only a fraction of a second, and too destructive to be ever tapped for productive use. And while anybody can produce minute quantities of static electricity by rubbing suitable materials or use small batteries that can last without recharging for hours of light-duty service in flashlights and portable electronics, generating electricity for mass-scale commercial use is a costly and complicated undertaking. its distribution from where it is generated to the places and regions of its largest use, to cities, industries, and electrified forms of rapid transportation, is equally complicated. It requires transformers and extensive grids of high-voltage transmission lines and, after further transformation, distribution by low-voltage overhead or underground wires to billions of consumers. And even in this era of high-tech electronic miracles, it is still impossible to store electricity affordably in quantities sufficient to meet the demand of a medium-sized city, 500,000 people, for only a week or two, or to supply a megacity, more than 10 million people, for just half a day. But despite these complications, high costs and technical challenges, we have been striving to electrify modern economies, and this quest for ever higher electrification will continue because this form of energy combines many unequaled advantages. Most obviously, at the point of its final consumption, electricity's use is always effortless and clean, and the majority of the time it is also exceptionally efficient. With just the flip of a switch, push of a button, or adjustment of a thermostat, now often requiring only a hand signal or voice command, electric lights and motors or electric heaters and coolers are turned on, with no bulky fuel storages, no laborious carrying and stoking, no dangers of incomplete combustion, emitting poisonous carbon monoxide, and no cleaning of lamps or stoves or furnaces. Electricity is the best form of energy for lighting. It has no competitor on any scale of private or public illumination, and very few innovations have produced such an impact on modern civilization as has the ability to remove the limits of daylight and to illuminate the night. All previous alternatives, from ancient wax candles and oil lamps to early industrial gas lights and kerosene cylinders, were feeble, costly, and highly inefficient. The most telling comparison of light sources is in terms of their luminous efficacy, their ability to produce a visual signal measured as the quotient of the total luminous flux, the total amount of energy put out by a source in lumens, and the source's power in watts. When setting the luminous efficacy of candles as equal to 1, coal gas lights in the early industrial cities produced 5 to 10 times more, before the First World War electric light bulbs with tungsten filaments emitted up to 60 times more. Today's best fluorescent lights produce about 500 times as much, and sodium lamps, used for outdoor lighting, are up to 1,000 times more efficacious. It is impossible to decide which class of electricity converters has had a greater impact, lights or motors. The conversion of electricity into kinetic energy by electric motors first revolutionized nearly every sector of industrial production and later penetrated every household niche. Less demanding manual tasks and those that deployed steam engines to lift, press, cut, weave, and other industrial operations were almost completely electrified. In the US, this took place within just 4 decades after the introduction of the first AC electric motors. By 1930, electric drive had nearly doubled American manufacturing productivity and had done so again by the late 1960s. Concurrently, electric motors began their gradual conquest of rail transportation, beginning with electric streetcars and then with passenger trains. The service sector now dominates all modern economies, and its operation is completely dependent on electricity. Electric motors power elevators and escalators, air-conditioned buildings, open doors, and compact garbage. They are also indispensable for e-commerce, as they power mazes of conveyor belts in giant warehouses. But the most ubiquitous units are never seen by people who rely on them every day. They are the tiny units activating mobile phone vibrators. The smallest ones measure less than 4 millimeters by 3 millimeters, their width being less than half the width of an average adult's pinky nail. You can see one only by dismantling your phone or watching a video of that operation online. In some countries, virtually all rail transport is now electrified, and all high-speed trains, up to 300 kilometers per hour, are powered either by electric locomotives or by motors mounted in multiple locations, as is the case with Japan's pioneering Shinkansen, launched in 1964. And even basic car models now have between 20 and 40 small electric motors, with many more in expensive cars. adding to the vehicle's weight and increasing the drain on its batteries. In households, besides lighting and powering all electronic devices, now commonly including security systems, electricity dominates mechanical tasks and supplies both heat and refrigeration in kitchens and energy for water heating, as well as heating for many houses. Without electricity, drinking water in all cities, as well as liquid and gaseous fossil fuels everywhere, would be unavailable. Powerful electric pumps feed water into the municipal supply, and they have an especially demanding task in cities with high commercial and residential densities, where water must be lifted to a great height. Electric motors run all the fuel pumps needed to move gasoline, kerosene, and diesel into tanks and wings. And while there may be plenty of natural gas in distribution gas pipelines, gas turbines are often used to move the fuel. In North America, where forced air heating dominates, small electric motors operate fans that push the air heated by natural gas through the ducts. The long-term trend toward the electrification of societies, rising share of fuels converted to electricity rather than consumed directly, has been unmistakable. The new renewables, solar and wind, as opposed to hydroelectricity, whose beginnings go back to 1882, will readily feed into this progression. But the history of electricity generation reminds us that many complications and complexities accompany the process, and that, despite its profound and rising importance, electricity still supplies only a relatively small share of final global energy consumption, just 18%. Before you flip a switch, we need to go back to the industry's beginnings to appreciate its foundations, its infrastructure, and the legacy of these 140 years of development. Commercial electricity generation began in 1882, with three firsts. Two of them were the pioneering coal-fired generating stations designed by Thomas Edison. Holborn Viaduct in London began operating in January 1882, Pearl Street Station in New York in September 1882, and the third was the first hydroelectric station on the Fox River in Appleton, Wisconsin, also generating since September 1882. Generation began to expand quickly during the 1890s, when alternating current or AC transmission prevailed over the existing direct current networks, and when new designs of AC electric motors began to be adopted by industry and households. In 1900, less than 2% of the world's fossil fuel production was used to generate electricity. By 1950, that share was still less than 10%. It now stands at about 25%. The concurrent expansion of hydroelectric capacity accelerated during the 1930s, with large state-funded projects in the USA and the USSR, and reached new highs after the Second World War, culminating in the construction of record-sized projects in Brazil. Itaipu completed in 2007 14 gigawatts, and China, Three Gorges, completed in 2012 22.5 gigawatts. Meanwhile, nuclear fission began to generate commercial electricity in 1956 at Britain's Calder Hall, saw its greatest expansion during the 1980s, peaked in 2006, and has since declined slightly to about 10% of global electricity generation. Hydro generation accounted for nearly 16% in 2020, wind and solar added almost 7%, and the rest, about two-thirds, came from large central stations fueled mostly by coal and natural gas. Not surprisingly, demand for electricity has been growing much faster than the demand for all other commercial energy. In the 50 years between 1970 and 2020, global electricity generation quintupled, while the total primary energy demand only tripled. And the growth of baseload generation, the minimum amount of electricity that has to be supplied on a daily, monthly, or annual basis, was further increased as progressively larger shares of populations moved to cities. Decades ago, American demand was lowest during summer nights, with shops and factories closed, public transport shut down, and all but a small share of the population asleep with open windows. Now the windows are shut as air conditioners hum through the night to make sleep possible during hot, muggy weather, In large cities and megacities, many factories run two shifts, and many shops and airports remain open 24 hours a day. Only COVID-19 stopped New York subway operating 24/7, and the Tokyo subway sleeps for just 5 hours. The first train from Tokyo Station to Shinjuku leaves at 5:16 a.m., and the last one at 20 past midnight. Satellite nighttime images taken years apart show how street, parking, and building lights shine ever brighter over ever larger areas that often join with nearby cities to form huge illuminated conurbations. A very high reliability of electricity supply. Grid managers talk about the desirability of reaching six nines. With 99.9999% reliability, there are only 32 seconds of interrupted supply in a year. It's imperative in societies where electricity powers everything from lights, be they in hospitals, along runways, or to indicate emergency escapes, to heart-lung machines and myriad industrial processes. If the COVID-19 pandemic brought disruption, anguish, and unavoidable deaths, those effects would be minor compared to having just a few days of a severely reduced electricity supply in any densely populated region. And if prolonged for weeks nationwide, it would be a catastrophic event with unprecedented consequences. Decarbonisation, pace and scale. There is no shortage of fossil fuel resources in the Earth's crust. No danger of imminently running out of coal and hydrocarbons. At the 2020 level of production, coal reserves would last for about 120 years, oil and gas reserves for about 50 years, and continued exploration would transfer more of them from the resource to the reserve, technically and economically viable, category. Reliance on fossil fuels has created the modern world, but concerns about the relatively rapid rate of global warming have led to widespread calls for doing away with fossil carbon as expeditiously as possible. Ideally, the decarbonisation of the global energy supply should proceed fast enough to limit average global warming to no more than 1.5 degrees Celsius, at worst 2 degrees Celsius. That, according to most climate models, would mean reducing net global CO2 emissions to zero by 2050, and keeping them negative for the remainder of the century. Notice the key qualifying adjective. The target is not total decarbonisation, but net zero or carbon neutrality. This definition allows for continued emissions to be compensated by, as yet non-existent, large-scale removal of CO2 from the atmosphere and its permanent storage underground, or by such temporary measures as the mass-scale planting of trees. By 2020, setting net zero goals for years ending in 5 or 0 has become a Me Too game. More than 100 nations have joined the lineup, ranging from Norway in 2030 and Finland in 2035, to the entire European Union, as well as Canada, Japan and South Africa in 2050, and China, the world's largest consumer of fossil fuels, in 2060. Given the fact that annual CO2 emissions from fossil fuel combustion surpassed 37 billion tonnes in 2019, the net zero goal by 2050 will call for an energy transition unprecedented in both pace and scale. A closer look at its key components reveals the magnitude of the challenges. Decarbonisation of electricity generation can make the fastest progress, because installation costs per unit of solar or wind capacity can now compete with the least expensive fossil fuel choices, and some countries have already transformed their generation to a considerable degree. Among large economies, Germany is the most notable example. Since the year 2000, it has boosted its wind and solar capacity tenfold and raised the share of renewables, wind, solar and hydro, from 11% to 40% of total generation. Intermittency of wind and solar electricity poses no problems as long as these new renewables supply relatively small shares of the total demand, or as long as any shortfalls can be made up by imports. As a result, many countries now produce up to 15% of all electricity from intermittent sources without any major adjustments, And Denmark shows how a relatively small and well interconnected market can go far higher. In 2019, 45% of its electricity came from wind generation, and this exceptionally high share can be sustained without any massive domestic reserve capacities, because any shortfalls can be readily made up by imports from Sweden, hydro and nuclear electricity, and Germany, electricity coming from many sources. Germany could not do the same. Its demand is more than 20 times the Danish total, and the country must maintain a sufficient reserve capacity that could be activated when new renewables are dormant. In 2019, Germany generated 577 terawatt hours of electricity, less than 5% more than in 2000, but its installed generating capacity expanded by about 73%, from 121 to about 209 gigawatts. The reason for this discrepancy is obvious. In 2020, 2 decades after the beginning of Energiewende, its deliberately accelerated energy transition, Germany still had to keep most of its fossil-fired capacity, 89% of it actually, in order to meet demand on cloudy and calm days. After all, in gloomy Germany, photovoltaic generation works on average only 11 to 12% of the time, and the combustion of fossil fuels still produced nearly half, 48%, of all electricity in 2020. Moreover, as its share of wind generation has increased, its construction of new high-voltage lines to transmit this electricity from the windy north to the southern regions of high demand has fallen behind. And in the US, where much larger transmission projects would be needed to move wind electricity from the Great Plains and solar electricity from the southwest to high-demand coastal areas, hardly any long-standing plans to build these links have been realised. As challenging as such arrangements are, they rely on technically mature and still improving solutions, that is, on more efficient PV cells, large onshore and offshore wind turbines, and high voltage, including long-distance direct current transmission. If costs, permitting processes, and not-in-my-backyard sentiments were no obstacles, these techniques could be deployed fairly rapidly and economically. Moreover, the problems of intermittency of solar and wind generation could be resolved by renewed reliance on nuclear electricity generation. A nuclear renaissance would be particularly helpful if we cannot develop better ways of large-scale electricity storage soon. We need very large, multi-gigawatt-hour storage for big cities and megacities, but so far the only viable option to serve them is pumped hydro storage, or PHS. It uses cheaper nighttime electricity to pump water from a low-lying reservoir to high-lying storage, and its discharge provides instantly available generation. With renewably generated electricity, the pumping could be done whenever surplus solar or wind capacity is available. But obviously, PHS can work only in places with suitable elevation differences, and the operation consumes about a quarter of generated electricity for the uphill pumping of water. Other energy storages, such as batteries, compressed air, and supercapacitors, still have capacities orders of magnitude lower than needed by large cities, even for a single day's worth of storage. In contrast, modern nuclear reactors, if properly built and carefully run, offer safe, long-lasting, and highly reliable ways of electricity generation. As already noted, they are able to operate more than 90% of the time, and their lifespan can exceed 40 years. Still, the future of nuclear generation remains uncertain. Only China, India, and South Korea are committed to further expansion of their capacities. In the West, the combination of high capital costs, major construction delays, and the availability of less expensive choices, natural gas in the US, wind and solar in Europe, has made new fission capacities unattractive. Moreover, America's new small, modular, and inherently safe reactors, first proposed during the 1980s, have yet to be commercialised, and Germany, with its decision to abandon all nuclear generation by 2022, is only the most obvious example of Europe's widely shared deep anti-nuclear sentiment. For the assessment of real nuclear generation risks, see Chapter 5. But this may not last. Even the European Union now recognises that it could not come close to its extraordinarily ambitious decarbonisation target without nuclear reactors. Its 2050 net zero emission scenarios set aside the decades-long stagnation and neglect of the nuclear industry and envisage up to 20% of all energy consumption coming from nuclear fission. Notice that this refers to total primary energy consumption, not just to electricity. Electricity is only 18% of total final global energy consumption, and the decarbonisation of more than 80% of final energy uses by industries, households, commerce and transportation will be even more challenging than the decarbonisation of electricity generation. Expanded electricity generation can be used for space heating and by many industrial processes now relying on fossil fuels, but the course of decarbonising modern long-distance transportation remains unclear. How soon will we fly intercontinentally on a wide-body jet powered by batteries? News headlines assure us that the future of flight is electric, touchingly ignoring the huge gap between the energy density of kerosene burned by turbofans and today's best lithium-ion batteries that would be on board these hypothetically electric planes. Turbofan engines powering jetliners burn fuel whose energy density is 46 megajoules per kilogram. That's nearly 12,000 watt-hours per kilogram, converting chemical to thermal and kinetic energy, while today's best lithium-ion batteries supply less than 300 watts per kilogram, more than a 40-fold difference. Admittedly, electric motors are roughly twice as efficient energy converters as gas turbines, and hence the effective density gap is only about 20-fold. But during the past 30 years, the maximum energy density of batteries has roughly tripled. And even if we were to triple that again, densities would still be well below 3,000 watts per kilogram in 2050, falling far short of taking a wide-body plane from New York to Tokyo or from Paris to Singapore, something we have been doing daily for decades with kerosene-fueled Boeings and Airbuses. Moreover, as will be explained in Chapter 3, we have no readily deployable commercial-scale alternatives for energising the production of the four material pillars of modern civilization solely by electricity. This means that even with an abundant and reliable renewable electricity supply, we would have to develop new large-scale processes to produce steel, ammonia, cement and plastics. Not surprisingly, decarbonisation outside of electricity generation has progressed slowly. Germany will soon generate half of its electricity from renewables, but during the two decades of Energiewende, the share of fossil fuels in the country's primary energy supply has only declined from about 84% to 78%. Germans like their unrestricted Autobahn speeds and their frequent intercontinental flying, and German industries hum on natural gas and oil. If the country replicates its past record, then in 2040, its dependence on fossil fuels will still be close to 70%. And what about countries that have not pushed renewables at extraordinary expense? Japan is the foremost example. In the year 2000, about 83% of its primary energy came from fossil fuels. In 2019, that share, due to the post-Fukushima loss of nuclear generation and the need for higher fuel imports, was 90%. And while the US has greatly reduced its dependence on coal, replaced by natural gas in electricity generation, the country's share of fossil fuels in primary energy supply was still 80% fossil in 2019. Meanwhile, China's share of fossil fuels fell from 93% in the year 2000 to 85% in 2019. But this relative decline was accompanied by a near tripling of the country's fossil fuel demand. The economic rise of China was the main reason why the global consumption of fossil fuels rose by about 45% during the first two decades of the 21st century, and why, despite extensive and expensive expansion of renewable energies, the share of fossil fuels in the world's primary energy supply fell only marginally, from 87% to about 84%. Annual global demand for fossil carbon is now just above 10 billion tonnes a year, amass nearly five times more than the recent annual harvest of all staple grains feeding humanity, and more than twice the total mass of water drunk annually by the world's nearly 8 billion inhabitants. And it should be obvious that displacing and replacing such a mass is not something best handled by government targets for years ending in 0 or 5. Both the high relative share and the scale of our dependence on fossil carbon make any rapid substitutions impossible. This is not a biased personal impression stemming from a poor understanding of the global energy system, but a realistic conclusion based on engineering and economic realities. In contrast to recent hasty political pledges, these realities have been recognised by all carefully considered long-term energy supply scenarios. The stated policies scenario, published by the International Energy Agency, or IEA, in 2020, sees the share of fossil fuels declining from 80% of the total global demand in 2019 to 72% by 2040. While the IEA Sustainable Development Scenario, its most aggressive decarbonisation scenario so far, allowing for substantially accelerated global decarbonisation, envisages fossil fuels supplying 56% of the global primary energy demand by 2040, making it highly improbable that this high share could be cut close to zero in a single decade. Certainly, the affluent world, given its wealth, technical capabilities, high level of per capita consumption, and the concomitant level of waste, can take some impressive and relatively rapid decarbonisation steps. To put it bluntly, it should do with using less energy of any kind. But that is not the case with the more than 5 billion people whose energy consumption is a fraction of those affluent levels, who need much more ammonia to raise their crop yields to feed their increasing populations, and much more steel and cement and plastics to build their essential infrastructures. What we need is to pursue a steady reduction of our dependence on the energies that made the modern world. We still do not know most of the particulars of this coming transition, but one thing remains certain. It will not be, it cannot be, a sudden abandonment of fossil carbon, nor even its rapid demise, but rather its gradual decline.